Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. I don't know if most readers are aware, but certainly most writers are aware that July means Thriller Fest. And Thriller Fest is the annual gathering of the writers and readers of thrillers, mysteries, and suspense that is hosted by the International Thriller Writers. It is a magnificent conference where you get to meet all the writers whose books you love to read, and you find out just how real and down to earth every single one of those top shelf and newbie authors really are. When we come back, I have a very special guest host who has a very special guest. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Joining me on this Monday night. It's just an exceptional week today, but tonight I want to start off first by remembering to thank the writer who's also a fantastic musician who does my theme music, Robert Gregory Brown. He also is mounting a stage production called Cradle Song. I hope you go to his page and look at it. And I want to thank our new sponsors for this show and others in the network, Down and Out Books, celebrating six award-winning years of crime fiction. You can find out more about their authors at www.downandoutbooks.com. Tonight, my guest host is KJ Howe. We know her more fondly as Kim. She is the executive director of Thriller Fest. She has written the most amazing book that hopefully is going to be nominated by all kinds of awards, because she certainly has earned rave reviews for The Freedom Broker. Kimberly, welcome to Authors on the Air, and thank you so much for agreeing to be the guest host in conversation tonight.
It's amazing to be here, and I really appreciate the invite.
Who is your guest tonight?
Well, we have a very special guest. His name is David Morrell, and he truly needs no introduction because he is the father of the basically American modern thriller, and as well as the co-founder of the International Thriller Writers and a best-selling author for 45 years.
Oh, my God. I'm going to let you go to it. In conversation with KJ Howe and David Morrell, have fun, and I'll be here.
Thank you kindly.
Yes, you can. Well, feel free to step in, please.
Yeah, anytime.
Oh, Professor, you're coming back to my show no matter what. You know it's a twice-a-year Jones I've got to have, and most certainly Kimberly will be back, too. You know,
you
I must
reminded
have
me,
you back
I sang
on.
One.
You did.
Exactly.
It was glorious. I'll leave you
well,
to
we'll,
it.
Maybe,
have fun.
Maybe we'll have, you dance tonight. Anyway, so David, with respect to, you know, this industry we're in, which is really a challenging one and completely changing dynamically as time goes on, and, you know, with the International Thriller Writers, two-thirds of our debut authors, sadly, don't write another book. Now, you have been writing for 45 years. Can you tell us a little bit about how? What do you attribute your longevity to?
First of all, let's start with what you said. And other people might find that surprising, but most first novelists do not write a second book. and I knew that statistic, but I'm impressed to hear it made real through International Thriller Writers. I think what happens is that when somebody is working on a novel for the first time, the struggle to put all the elements together is so extreme that when it's all done, there's a kind of an exhaustion that sets in. And in the modern publishing world, where they want you ideally to have a book a year, the daunting task of doing it again and not knowing what to do that perhaps wouldn't be just an imitation of the first book, all of that put together, I just sympathize with the people in that position, and I can relate to it. It took me 3 years to write my first novel, First Blood. I started it in 68 and finished it in 71. Oh my God, so long ago. Published in 72, and I had a terrible problem with the second novel, and that took me another 3 years, a book called Testament, which came out in 75. And then after that, I got my legs, so to speak. But I always thought that the second novel was harder than the first because maybe there were more expectations. You know, my heart goes out to all those folks that weren't quite able to do another one. And it ain't easy, and it's and as you say, they're not alone. It's a lot of people have faced that. Now, in terms of the 45 years, which is hard for me to relate to, and it all seems to have been very rapid. But when you say 45 years, I saw early as I was going from decade to decade, that maybe the average career lasted about 20 years. Some people got sick, some people, God bless them, passed on, but others dropped away. And my perception was that people had started with something that worked, and they did that again, and then they did it again. And along about the 20th year, they got tired just as their readers got tired. And maybe they went another 5 years, but unless they had found a way to refresh everything and make themselves interested, that was about as long as you could go. And so what I did, there are ups and downs to this. The good news is that I followed where my imagination took me, and even though it wasn't something that I was known for, in the 70s I was writing outdoor action, in the 80s I was writing espionage, and, you know, we could do similar distinctions in the other decades, but it was, we have a mutual friend, Steve Barry. And when I told him that my recent books were going to be Victorian mystery thrillers, he looked at me kind of stunned and said, you son of a bitch, you reinvented yourself again. And that's sort of, you know, been, I think, the secret to why I kept going, is that as my interest flagged, I said, okay, I'm going to find a new way to do action and suspense. That's the good news. You get longevity. The bad news is that people who identify with me as a outdoor action person, say like with Rambo and First Blood, maybe weren't going to switch to do to be with me as an espionage writer, or wouldn't be with me for my three recent books, the Victorian mystery thrillers. So I think that some readers dropped out while I gained new readers each time I was doing something slightly different and sometimes very different. So I got longevity, but I didn't necessarily grow the fan base the way someone who starts with one idea and just builds on it might have had a fan base.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough, and that's an excellent analysis. And you know, you've always told me that when you're going to write a book, you're going to spend at least a year doing it, and you want to make sure that you evolve as a person, change, learn, grow. And can you talk a little bit maybe about the research you've done and with different books and, you know, how that's impacted your whole life? Because it sounds like you immerse yourself so deeply in your work that, you know, these changes are really healthy because they stimulate you for growth in other areas.
I'm the Daniel Day-Lewis of authors.
Love that.
He goes off, and if he's going to be a shoemaker, he'd be learning to make shoes. If he's going to be a farmer, actually, I think he is a farmer. You know, he just immerses himself, and I'm reminded of Paul Newman, and I'm obviously not comparing abilities here, just methods. I'm reminded of Paul Newman that who worked on when he was making HUD, a film about Texas ranchers, that he went down to a Texas ranch and worked on the ranch and watched them and particularly learned how they were speaking, you know, the cadence and the way they talked. I always sort of knew this, but with my son's death, my son Matthew was 15. In 1987, he died from a very, very rare form of bone cancer called Ewing's sarcoma, which only about 200 people get in the United States each year. And that really, really brought to my realization the value of time, that was actually the only currency that mattered. And so I had been that way before, but I became almost ruthless about it, that for writing, I was not going to do, I mean, it takes me a year. Now, sometimes it's taken me less, but sometimes it's taken me more. And when you figure the editing process and all of that, it's a year. So I thought, all right, you know, that's a lot of time. And so I write, it's a lot of people have heard me talk about this, and it's in my writing book, that I write a letter to myself before I start a project. And I ask myself why the project is worth a year of my life. And okay, yes, we're not doing this for total idealistic reasons. It would be nice to earn an income from the writing. But apart from that, I always felt that there had to be something about the theme that was personally meaningful to me, and that maybe it was something I needed to work out for myself, that there had to be something about the way the book was written that was just different enough, without being wildly experimental, just different enough that it too would keep me interested, that I was sort of creating something new. And then what you mentioned, the research. And the research comes in many forms. You know, somebody once said, well, write what you know about. Well, how about approaching it from a different point of view? Learn what you want to write about. And so I often picked topics that I was really, really curious about. I wrote a novel about a thriller about a photographer in the 1990s called Double Image. Mm-hmm. And I'd always been interested in that, and partly because I associate photography with death. Because if you think about it, photography stops time. And the interest of when we look at, well, not all photographs, art photographs tend to be in a different category, but, you know, we say, oh, boy, you look so young then, or look at how the style of the clothes I wear, look at how that changed, and, hey, that the house wasn't the same color then, and you know, oh, my God, look at how little those trees were. And it's about how time has been stopped by the photograph. It took me a long time to realize my interest in photography was morbid. And in any case, once I decided that trying to understand why I identified photography with death was worth writing a novel about. And then I took a course at a local college here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a course in photography. I spent a lot of time with the photographer who conducted the course and with other photographers in the area. I read, of course, a ton of books on the subject. And then I went down to a local gallery in Santa Fe, the Andrew Smith Gallery, and I introduced myself and told people what I was doing. And I said, you know, tell me why that photograph over there is worth $100,000. How did it get to be worth that much? And so they would describe to me the intricacy, and this is before digital photography. This is darkroom technique and dodging and burning and things. And I just found the whole process amazing. Some days on Saturdays I used to go down and they knew me. And I told him I'll pretend to be a customer and looking at the photos. And meanwhile, they're explaining to their customers about the photographs on the walls. And I just learned a ton. And you, Kimberly, you know that I'm a private pilot and that I became one because of a novel I wrote about mysterious lights that appear in West Texas known as the Marfa lights, and they're real. Nobody knows what they are, and I've seen them, and they're just amazing. And they had been noticed in particular during World War II by pilots who were training at a nearby base for combat, and they chased the lights, and sometimes the lights chased them, and very weird stuff. And I thought, hey, this is cool. I know I've got to have aircraft in this novel. Why don't I learn about being a pilot? And finally got my my pilot's license, and then realized that my father, who died in combat, was a pilot, and that he had been shot down. So, you know, I suddenly said, whoa, you know, there's something about all this that maybe relates to the loneliness that I felt when I was a young boy without a parent, without a male parent. So I lived at one time in Wyoming in the Wind River Range at the first 30 days at Timberline as a part of the National Outdoor Leadership School's Wilderness Guide Program, and I spent a week learning how to car fight at the Bill Scott Raceway in West Virginia and lots of other stuff. And you and I, of course, share an interest in knowing about firearms when we write about them. So I know you've had it be worth, you know, maybe you're saying a few words about your firearms training, but you can't, really, you can't write thrillers without, you know, having some knowledge of that. And so it's just been quite, there are other things I could mention, but it's been, the research can be like a Walter Mitty thing where, you know, where the, I'm the mild-mannered professor, and then, you know, I'd be, you know, the bloody-minded visions, you know, of the research.
I love that, actually, because, you know, my fascination with kidnapping and, you know, being really immersed in that world for the last several years, and people always say, what's a nice Canadian girl like you writing about kidnapping for?
Well, exactly, but, and, you know, and to turn the tale here, because you and I talked for many years at Thriller Fest. It's our annual a ritual where we meet for breakfast and often talk otherwise about, you know, the psychological motivations unknown to us that drive us to certain subjects. And so, you know, I might say the same to you. What the kidnapping, where did that come from?
Yeah, I've been really trying to understand that, actually. And I think perhaps maybe because I lived internationally and I was often, you know, in the new kid in town and in foreign environments where there was a level of threat. And it was kind of this overarching shadow. And I think I felt danger was there. And quite often, like, for example, my parents lived in Saudi Arabia and there wasn't a school available for a young lady. And so I was sent to boarding school, and perhaps it was a sense of, you know, being transported and stuck somewhere, right? I mean, I say go for it, you know, as a psychologist, because you're really good at this. But I definitely feel that, that it was kind of like maybe being forced to stay places where I wasn't entirely comfortable. And so, you know, in no way does that represent the, like, the level of distress that most kidnapping victims, you know, go through, because, I mean, they're, they have horrible hygiene and poor food and things like that. But the emotional aspects, I think, are somewhat similar.
Yes. Very interesting. Yeah, you know, maybe sometime, maybe we'll sit down and talk further about that. The it's often everybody has a dominant emotion. That this is something that was taught to me by my creative writing teacher back at Penn State, a wonderful man whose real name was Philip Klass, but whose pen name was William Ten. And he spent hours with me talking, you know, kind of the way you and I talk. And he said, you know, everybody has a dominant emotion. And if you can come to terms with understanding what your, what my dominant emotion is, was, that I would know what I wanted to write about. And for most of my life, my emotion had been based upon fear. because I'd had such a rough upbringing and being put in an orphanage without knowing where I was, and my stepfather and my mother arguing and me sleeping under the bed for fear and things like that. And, you know, it's sort of, I was programmed in a way to feel that anything, any time could be a threat. And I think while the circumstances were different with you, there is that you know, being out of control of your of what you want to do and where people are taking you. And I don't want to do this, but I don't have a choice. So I think that there's a kind of empathy you have for that kind of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting how I chose something that was very international because, you know, basically I think I was a bit of a child of the world, even though I was born in Toronto, Canada. I've lived all over the place. And, it's kind of home Toronto, but at the same time, you know, I feel like very comfortable wherever I am. So it's sort of like you adopt the world as your home.
That's
fascinating.
Fascinating. In contrast, I tend to want to be in a cave.
like under the bed, right?
They can't. Yeah,
safe,
there you go. There you go.
Right?
They can't get at me, right? They can't get at me.
Yeah, protected. And so speaking of that, like, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, like you said, the mild-mannered professor, you know, the child that had to hide under the bed creates one of the most iconic action heroes of all time with Rambo. And I find that so interesting. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, Rambo became like a part of the English language. And
Yes. That
is like got to be a dream come true as far as an author goes, because you created something that wasn't there before and will always be there. And Rambo is often used as an adjective, noun, verb, you know, it's everything.
Mm-hmm.
When did it first hit you that that had become what it was?
After the movie came out, but I mean, the book had, you know, the history is that I had worked on the book for 3 years, and I had, at Penn State, my master's degree thesis was about Hemingway's style. I had studied there with a great Hemingway scholar named Philip Young, who is the reason I migrated from Canada to the United States. And I don't write like Hemingway, and again, I, you know, not trying to compare quality, but the idea that came to me was that Hemingway had written about action as if no one had ever written about it before. And he had refused to use the standard cliches of a shot rang out and gun smoke filled the air, which I still see in thrillers today. This makes me cringe. And I thought, all right, could it be possible to write an action book that didn't feel like a genre book? That was my mission statement. And I thought, if I follow Hemingway's example, then, you know, with no pretense that I had his skill, but if I followed his example, maybe I could write an action book that felt as if it hadn't, nothing like it had been written before. And, you know, how that whole thing came about and how the novel was written, you know, is a totally different story. But when I finished, I realized that it was one of the more intense action books. I hadn't realized until other people were reading it how strong it was. I sent the book to my favorite thriller writer, Geoffrey Household, a British suspense writer who was famous for having written a 1939 novel called Rogue Mail, R-O-G-U-E, Mail, M-A-L-E, about a British big game hunter who stalks Hitler on the eve of the Second World War and gets caught on the first page. Just a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. And he and I had corresponded. I had told him how much I loved his work, and, you know, he responded. And then you know, I finished First Blood, and I sent him the thing, and he wrote back, you know, I wanted a quote, I said, and, you know, if he wouldn't mind. And he wrote back and basically said he would mind. He couldn't possibly give it a quote. It was far too bloody. And I thought, well, hell, the title might have been a clue.
And
when, you know, it was reviewed so well everywhere, and I think part of this was 1972 at the climax, sort of, so to speak, of the disenchantment with the war. And the reviews were, it was just amazing everywhere. Many of the magazines no longer exist. Life, Saturday Review, Newsweek, Time, and on and on and on, New York Times, and on. And but Time was the only negative review, and Time said that I had invented a new kind of novel called the meat novel, what the reviewer called carnography, which was the action equivalent of pornography. And despite the snarkiness, that reviewer's was in line with what Jeffrey Household was saying, that this was something different. And I didn't really know, except, you know, I want to write an action novel that didn't feel like a genre book, try to make it real. And so that, the shock of the novel continued for 10 years. It had sold immediately to the movies. But there were problems because of its intensity for the movie to get made. It was just too strong. It was like Sam Peckinpah movie, but not a Western, and nobody knew how to do that until 1982, 10 years later, when two guys, Andrew Vanya and Mario Kossar, I like both of them a lot, they formed a film company called Carol Co., and they said, this is what we're going to make, because they'd heard about it from various places. And then, you know, it was a huge hit in its own way, making a difference in film the way the novel made a difference in books. To answer your question, I remember I don't know Sylvester Stallone well, but he and I had crossed paths as the second film was coming out, and we both basically said the same thing to each other, that it's very weird to be associated with this force that was flying through around the globe. And he said what I was feeling, that he would hear the word Rambo or hear the character referred to, and that it would take him about 5 seconds to remember that he was associated with it, just as I was having that same thing, that I was associated with it. And to this day, and unless I know it's coming, when I hear the word Rambo and, you know, all the stuff that you were talking about, there's that time delay where, I am part of the audience, and then all of a sudden I realize, hey, wait, that's my guy.
Wow, that's incredible.
So it's an odd kind of dissociative experience. And, you know, it's still going on. There's a new edition of First Blood, never been out of print, and it's coming. There's a new edition coming out this fall from Grand Central. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was a major collector's edition from Gauntlet Press, which had not only the text but all kinds of important essays, to do background essays, and also the original first chapter, which was not the one that was used in the novel. So, I mean, you know, it just keeps going. It's
amazing.
Of,
yeah, I have a copy of that, actually, so it's amazing.
They did a great job.
Mm-hmm, they sure did. It's a beautiful packaging. If anyone doesn't have one and would like one, I highly recommend getting it. And so with Rambo, you know, we talked about this earlier before we were on the show about it, you know, in some ways the kind of Western slant, right, of how, you know, he came into town, lone stranger. I've read your essay on John Wayne, and I found that really interesting. And I'd love for you to talk about, you know, John Wayne and what you learned about him. And did that influence, I know you're a huge fan, did that influence your fiction?
It had to. I'll tell you a story of something that occurred to me recently, but I'll just finish the thought about John Wayne. I grew up in the 50s, and John Wayne Westerns were, dominant. And I just felt, again, it's like photography. You know, I wanted to understand this. So I wrote a long essay, I think it's about 13,000 words, called John Wayne, the Westerns. And it's a, you know, it's like a book condensed into 13,000 words, and it's available as an e-book, and it's also available as part of another Gauntlet Books collector's item called Stars in My Eyes, My Love Affair with Books, Movies, and Music, that has it and a long essay about Steve McQueen and about High Noon and, you know, a lot of Western stuff there. And also Frank Sinatra and Bobby Darin and Hemingway and lots of stuff, you know, my interests. But I recently, here's one of these psychological revelations, you know, the way our minds work that we don't quite understand. The first movie that I was allowed to see by myself in a theater, when my mother finally decided I was old enough that I could safely leave where we lived and go to a theater by myself, was a Western, a Richard Widmark Western, which I wouldn't have known at the time was directed by Delmer Davies, but I know now, called The Last Wagon. It's a really, really good picture. It's held up. And I know this because with DVDs, that film was released, and I thought, you know, I haven't seen this thing in a while. I should have a look at it. And so I'm watching, and my wife and I, and I'm looking at it, and I said, holy shit, this reminds me of Rambo.
Wow.
And then I said, wow, just think, the first film I saw in a theater alone, and it's this film, and somehow it stayed in my DNA, so that years later, when, you know, Rambo, it's all Richard Widmark running through the forest, getting even with people, and it's like, you know, some elements, you wouldn't find a parallel, and you wouldn't know unless I told you, you know, that this, okay, these two things merged somehow, but there it was staring at me that I had absorbed. And then I remembered a Glenn Ford movie called The Sheepman, in which another one I saw in the 50s, but by then, you know, it was no big deal to go by myself. But the plot of that, it's a comedy, but nonetheless, Glenn Ford comes to town and they find out he's a sheep man and it's a ranching town. Well, we can't have this, so they boot him out of town. And, of course, he comes back. And they boot him out of town, and he comes back. And I, somewhere in my DNA, that kind of pattern showed up in First Blood at the beginning, you know, with Rambo and the police officer. But that, well, Sheepman's a comedy, and God knows First Blood is not a comedy. So, you know, there were things that and I don't think there's any storyteller who it can't, who could deny that, you know, that whatever moved us when we were youths, that we were somehow maybe, you know, controlled by and reinterpreting, you know, as adults. I always felt when I was writing this that yes, it's contemporary and it's, you know, there aren't any horses and there's none of this, but I always thought of it as a Western. The high concept for me was that a gunfighter would come to town, and we've seen this in a lot of Westerns, and the law wouldn't let him hang up his guns. So that kind of primordial feeling that you get in Westerns, was something that I was trying for. And when I was writing the climax, the gunfight, the running gunfight through the town, I very much had High Noon, the gunfight at the end of High Noon in mind. So, you know, I mean, and again, this is not, I'm not listening from me. Some people listening to me might say, hey, I don't get it. You know, I don't see the parallel, but I did. And in many ways, a lot of my novels are Westerns.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100%. And do you have any thoughts on why Western movies are so successful, but Western books struggle?
Well, they haven't been recently. I mean, they, the Western movies recently. I just got back from Kansas City, where the Western Writers of America had its convention, and I'm a member, and I write for the Roundup magazine, the magazine of the Western writers. And I was on a panel, and we were talking about, you know, the failure of the Lone Ranger movie, and the comparative failure of the remake of The Magnificent Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if these pictures had, these are big pictures, and if they had been successful, more big Westerns would have been made. But the problem is, and the consensus both on the panel and the people who were there listening to us, was that the problem is that neither script was worth anything. That they repeated themselves, and they ignored the core of what made a good Western, or, you know, the core of the Lone Ranger myth, in order to get fancy. At one point, there's the gunfight in The Magnificent Seven is like a video game gunfight.
It goes on forever.
And it's also set up so that the gun, it becomes like, you know, in some video games are called first-person shooter games. And you know, the handgun would come up as in a video game, and, you know, the target would be as in a video game, and this is in The Magnificent Seven, and bang, and then the target would go down. And it was obviously an attempt to pander to a, you know, not to respect the genre, but instead to, you know, go to people who wouldn't treat the genre seriously. Now, in contrast, the Spur Award this year for Best Western Film went to Hell or High Water, which is a contemporary film with starring Jeff Bridges.
Mm, I've seen it. It's great.
It's a wonderful movie, and it's about, you know, you and I had talked about Westerns, and I said that one definition that the group I spend most time with talking about Westerns came up with is that Westerns are about where civilization meets savagery. And that can be, you know, a traditional Western, or it can be a modern Western where Jeff Bridges is a, you know, the last day on the job, a Texas Ranger, going against bank robbers. And we've seen this before, but it's been rejuvenated, and it has this great, great social message where the bank that's foreclosing on the bad guys, so to speak, bad guys, I put it in quotes, property is the bank they rob.
I know, isn't that great?
So the money they get from the bank, they can bring back in and use to pay off the loan. I mean,
that was great irony.
Just so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then the second, the runner-up, was another a contemporary Western called Desierto, which is about a hunter who gets his kicks by shooting Mexican immigrants as they cross the border. Obviously very very topical and politically laden, but there is no politics in the film. It's almost like The Most Dangerous Game. There again, civilization and savagery. Now, significantly, neither of these films made any money. I think Hell or High Water in the United States maxed out at $30 million. Now, mind you, it only cost $5 to $7 million. If you do the rule of four on the budget, about $28 million was the break even. So it might have made, you know, a little bit down the road. If it went to $40 million for everything, you know, somebody would have got something. But it would not be, say, what's happening with Wonder Woman, where they're just going to, boy, what a wonderful movie that is. But another subject. Now, this year, there are several major films coming out, and the one that westerns, the one that everybody's looking at, is Taylor Sheridan, the same guy who did Hell or High Water, a picture called Wind River, western set in Wyoming, modern day, in which a body is discovered on an Indian reservation, and an Anglo law enforcement officer has to work with a female Indian officer in order to solve the crime. So, you know, that comes out in August. We're really looking forward to that. And who knows, you know, it might make some money. And if it does, then we're going to get more and more. But I can tell you in terms of novels, you know, everybody waits for the day when something like True Grit will come back, the novel, which was a huge publishing event, sleeper as it were, and it, boy, did it get strong. And you know, I think what we're just waiting for is one day somebody's like Larry McMurtry with Lonesome Dove, but you know, that someone will come along right now with a novel that has that chord to it and that will cause a renaissance in publishing. I mean, there's great stuff going on. And my friend Johnny D. Boggs, I'm in Santa Fe and a lot of authors here, and I'm a part of a Western watching group, and one of the guys in it is Johnny D. Boggs, and Johnny is he just won his 7th Spur Award, which ties him for the record, which was previously held by Elmer Kelton, whose novels are just legendary in the Western field. And, you know, I read his stuff, and I read, he did a novel called Northfield about the Northfield bank robbery in which the James and Younger brothers were involved, and he decided to tell it in first person narratives with all the participants, is, you know, as if they were all, you know, it's like the first person's kind of circle the bank robbery, and you see it from all these different perspectives. And I think Johnny told me there are 23 first person narratives in it. Now, this is not genre writing. We're now dealing with a whole different level. And he did the same thing with the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the anniversary of which will be next year. In which it's a novel called Greasy Grass, which is the Indian term for where the Little Bighorn was. And he uses multiple first-person narrators in order to get a different focus with each chapter on what the heck happened there. Well, you know, once again, we're talking about high art. And so, I mean, we have just some brilliant authors working in the Western form now, but, you know, you need, as you're aware and I'm aware because of, you know, our relationship with our publishers, you need the financial commitment from the publisher if people are finally going to know about what it is we're writing. And publishers don't have money to push.
Excuse me for interrupting. I want you to know that you have a caller. So let me go ahead and introduce the caller. Hi, area code 781. You're live on the air. Who's this?
Good afternoon. This is Jeff, R.J. Jeffries.
Yes.
Well, hello, R.J. Jeffries. You're on with K.J. Howe and Professor David Morrell.
It's
lovely to hear from you.
Very engaging interview. I had a quick question. Thriller Fest, I'm also a writer as well, and enjoy thriller novels, probably the best. Any experiences or any real surprises you had at a Thriller Fest event? Some guest or someone walked up and tapped you on the shoulder and said hi, and you were just like, oh, I'm such a fan. Something that just said it kind of was memorable. I'm just curious.
Well, I want to just tell you, first of all, that was my experience. When I met Professor Morrell, Jeff, I was in tears.
Mm-hmm.
I had my ratty old cover. I had my ratty old book, my paperback book, the first paperback edition that came out of Brotherhood of the Rose. He hears the story all the time from me. The cover was falling off, but I had taped it back together and brought it with me. And John Land laughed at me. He said, Pam, go to the book room and buy a new book. And I said, no, this is the book that got me turned on to suspense and espionage and everything else. And I could barely even speak. And Professor Morrell said, let me have your book, I'm going to sign it. And he did, and then he ended up going to the book table and handing me his current work at that time and signed that book too. I have been such a fangirl of David Morrell forever, but then meeting him in person, it was a bucket list moment. And of course, Kimberly Howe, who is the queen of all things Thriller Fest, could not be kinder or more generous. I will tell you that from the first time I went to every time I've gone, she's an incredible woman. So maybe they'll have, you know, as the executive director, Kim has unique insight, but Professor Morrell is the one who actually co-founded with Gail Linz the ITW. So I think
briefly before they answer that, you've just expressed to me my dream is that someone walks up to me and they've read my book so many times and so many people have shared it with them and they've shared it with others that it's all dog-eared and about falling apart. That's my dream. Say that wonderful story, Pam. Thank you. Please.
I really hope it comes true for you. I mean,
absolutely.
I love hearing Pam's story because Pam. The reason I wanted to write fiction was because I read The Brotherhood of the Rose. So when you said that, it kind of gave me chills.
Yeah.
You know, like back in the day when I was traveling all around, and my parents lived internationally, and I that book and you know, the espionage books David wrote, just they really resonated with me, I think, because I was kind of living that life in a way. And from that moment on, you know, when I was actually I met David first when I was doing my master's in creative writing. He came as the guest speaker, and that was a very, very special moment. It wasn't at Thriller Fest per se, but it's amazing to me that is the reason. He is the reason I wanted to be a writer, and you know, to be able to meet him, and then now, you know, be the executive director at the conference of the organization which David co-founded is pretty incredible.
Damn, you people are making me feel real good.
Good, as we want to do.
Well, good, because you've made us feel amazing. You know, I've read every single one of your books, Professor. You know that. And David Lassamy, because I still call him Professor,
we should maybe explain where that comes from.
Let me explain where I started calling you that, because at that same conference when John Land laughed at me about having that book, I said to him, oh, God, will you please introduce me to David Morrell? And I was a nervous wreck. I was shaking like a leaf. I had tears in my eyes. I'm such a big fangirl. And John just said, oh, you want to meet the professor? No problem. And so ever since that time, not even knowing David Morrell's background, he's always been the professor to me, except for the fact that he was a professor. So please tell the story, David, because it just cracks me up. Even when I write to you, I call you professor, don't I?
It caught. But, I mean, I was, in fact, a professor. After I graduated, I got a Ph.D. from Penn State in American Lit. And I mention that because, you know, my upbringing was so awful that there were many people who didn't think I would get out of high school. And it's a well-known story that I tell often that a television show called Route 66 and the writing by Sterling Siliphant basically redeemed me and showed me what I was meant to do. And Sterling answered a letter of mine, and he told me what to do, which was just keep writing, keep learning. And, you know, I just kept going, and the next thing I knew, I was an actual professor, to everybody's shock, teaching American Lit at the University of Iowa. And I resigned in 1986, you know, once a professor, always a professor. And so John and a number of other people started to pick up on that. And also they know if they have a question about literary history or something, that I'll be able to answer it. So I, you know, I'm a kind of a walking encyclopedia, but it makes me smile. It's a very affectionate term, and I appreciate it.
Well, it's always been. Even when we write emails to each other, I still say professor.
John does, but John Land does the same thing.
Well, I figure you'll know it's me, first of all, if you get an email that says, dear professor,
yeah,
you'll know
yeah.
who it is, you know.
Yep.
And so, Jeff, I don't know. Can David Morrell have a fan guy experience? I don't know. Anybody that you can really?
Well, I mean, when you look at Thriller Fest, you know, there was one of the reasons why the organization, why Gail and I, with help from a lot of people, co-founded it, was that we thriller writers tended to you know, we didn't, we had a lot of people we read and that we admired, but we'd never met them. And in a certain way, you know, I thought this would be cool if we had an organization where we could all get together and find out, you know, who's who and you know, just chat. And the spirit of that really became very strong in ITW. I mean, when you think of all the hugely popular, exciting novelists who are just walking the hallway and being very friendly, you know, being just ready to chat and have no, you know, I mean, it's very open and very personal.
It really is.
There's a novelist called Charles McCary, and he wrote a novel, one of these JFK conspiracy novels called The Tears of Autumn. It's set in Vietnam, and it's one of the big, it's a really, really important espionage novel. And but he had never, you know, been to Thriller Fest, and he's not a brand name like, you know, Lee Child is, for example, who is there often and very accessible. And I must say, when I met Charles McCary and had a chance to shake his hand, I was thought, oh boy, you know, we're definitely first class territory here, you know.
I'm sorry, Jeff. Go ahead.
Okay. I work with VITA, Women in Literary Arts, for parody. And I always, any time I publicly express this, VITA, Women in Literary Arts, follow them, join them, support them, for parody for women and women of color and transgender. Just women need to be just in the forefront as us men do. No more old school boys club. They belong there. They deserve their since day one. So I'll kick this box.
You're right, and I will... And I agree with you, Jeff, and here's the thing that I love about this organization, okay? So the co-founders are a man and a woman. Every year there's going to be the Thriller Master, there's going to be the award winners, there's going to be somebody who's named for their philanthropic work in the industry and all. And every year it's even Steven, and I love that. And the nice thing about this organization is that up-and-coming writers also can talk. They have access to all of these wonderful people, and the committees and levels are headed up by an even number of men and women, I would venture to say. Of course, David and Kim, you can back up those numbers better than I can, but there are so many amazing people. Who is your headliner this year?
Well, Lee Child will be our Thriller Master, and for his Lifetime Achievement, which is so well deserved, and Lisa Gardner, and last year was Heather Graham. So, and then our Silver Bullet Award, which is our charity award, will be receiving. Lisa Gardner will be receiving that this year.
And isn't that amazing? Because I was so thrilled when Heather got it, and I was so thrilled when Anne Rice, and I saw Anne Rice, and I know Heather. I knew Heather. Do you know I met Heather before I knew Heather was famous? Because we lived in the same town. Yeah, and she was amazing. But
and
it's
Sandra
a good
Brown,
thing, Jeff, you know. And Sandra Brown.
I need to put in another plug for Kim. Kim and I are on Facebook. She's an amazing writer. I'm wishing her unparalleled success with The Freedom Broker.
There you
amazing.
Go.
So I'm honored to say, well, we're connected 1 degree to each other on Facebook, and I follow her work. My quick answer, Rita, was I got an opportunity to interview Rita Dove, one of our former United States Poet Laureates for Vita, and we only had a time limit of about 20 minutes, and, you know, you figure, get to that person, you're so lucky, take the time. But her husband, Fred, sort of set up the Skype interview. We did it video. And it turned out to be she was the most open, sharing, and giving person. That 20 minutes turned out to be 3 hours. Mm. 20 minutes preparing an hour interview and 2 hours, an hour or so after that, of just talking amongst us, me and my host, Melissa. So, again, you said the operative word approachable, and everybody at Thriller Fest, I'm sure, is the same way. Don't be afraid, listeners. We come up to them. They'd love to talk with you, and you'd be amazed how open they are.
You know, Jeff, let me tell you a little side story about I had always heard about Thriller Fest and all, and being the reader fanatic that I am, as you know, I read about 400 books a year. I was on an MJ Rose kick, and this particular year they were having Fan Fest, and MJ Rose was holding a contest on her page to say she'd like to invite someone to be her guest at Fan Fest, but they really had to be able to go. She didn't want to just say, okay, you win. And I said, oh, my God, I'll go, and I'll interview you, and I'll go. Standing in a room with all these people who you've been reading their books, not necessarily all your life, but you've been reading their books and everything they write has affected you, is, if I could tell you that there's something higher on my list, on my bucket list, there is no such thing. There's nothing, which is why I ingratiate myself in every book conference I can. I go to meet the people who give my life so much joy. So I'm really blessed. I want to just say thank you for calling in, RJ Jeffries. You are an amazing friend. I'm so glad we had a chance to talk, and we'll talk again soon, yes?
Thank you so much. For
yeah, thank you for the kind words.
Best,
very
best,
appreciated.
Best wishes.
Good luck with your work.
Erin Kim.
Have a nice evening.
And
I want to just finish up this interview with a couple of questions. KJ Howe, your book, The Freedom Broker, is magnificent. It's doing well. It's a bestseller. You've been blurbed by everybody. Are you working on your next book?
I am, actually, and I was very lucky to receive the cover for my next book, which is called Skyjack, and I was able to share it with David, and he gives thumbs up, so it makes me feel
very
happy.
It's an amazing cover. I can't say enough good things about it. It draws... It actually invites, somehow psychologically invites the reader's imagination to enter the story. It's just this astonishing cover.
Let's hope the
inside. I'd love to do a big promo for you to redo a cover reveal. And of course, you know, you're always welcome back here, Kim. And I'm sure that, you know, the now 18 shows we have, that half of them are going to want to interview you again. So please make sure you come back for that. David Morrell, you are always welcome on this show, and I hope that the next time you come back, it's because you've taken the microphone and you're having an in-conversation episode.
May I just say that
you both have motivated me so much that this year the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network is publishing 2 anthologies that I've put together. How about that?
Phenomenal. Good for you.
Terrific.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
And it's really interesting. One is as a benefit for survivors of domestic violence. David, you and I have talked about that before. You know
I've
been a survivor. And the other one's a big surprise, and I think you both will be really, you'll be interested, and it'll be fun. But I want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for being here. You're 2 of my most favorite people in the whole wide world. You know that. And we'll be in touch. I'm sorry I'll miss you at Thriller Fest this year. But I promise you, next year I will be there, I promise you, with bells on. I'm even going to go early so I can spend time with you both.
Well, we'll miss you, but we look forward to seeing you again.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. And Kim, will you please give everybody the information about Thriller Fest, the dates, and where they can find out more information?
Absolutely. We have a phenomenal website at thrillerfest.com, and it's July 11 to 15 this year, only 2 weeks away, but you can still book and come. We'd love to see you. And if anyone has any questions, my email is actually on the website. Don't hesitate to reach out to me anytime. I love hearing from our attendees.
And David Morrell, what would you say to first-time novelists who are looking for a home? How good of a fit will ITW be for them?
Well, it's in different segments, of course, but the Craft Fest, when I started, there wasn't any way to learn this stuff unless you were fortunate to find somebody like Philip Klass who was willing to teach me. But here we have a day and a half of some of the very, very best thriller writers in the world who are donating their time to speak for an hour on various subjects. and, you know, very big names. Lee Child, we mentioned him before because he's the Thriller Master this year. You know, a lot of people come in, you know, to get the award and scram, but not Lee. He's, you know, he's going to be doing an hour of, you know, talking about writing, along with a whole lot of other people. I'm not in Lee's category, but I'm going to talk for an hour as well about writing. And, you know, it's...
Speaking about Lee, I just have an observation. And this is kind of like off the subject, but don't you think if Lee put on about 50 pounds, he'd be the perfect reacher? Because it
could be.
And also, he is one of the kindest, most down-to-earth human beings, although you have to really look up high to see him because he's very tall. Just so that you know, every single person is accessible at this conference. The other thing besides Craft Fest is you have Pitch Fest. And how important is that, Professor?
Well, I was just at the Western Writers, and they were wishing that there were more agents there so people could actually, you know, the big mystery is, how do I get published? Well, you got to get an agent. Well, how do I get an agent? Well, you know, at least at Thriller Fest, there's an afternoon where some of the very biggest agents in the nation make themselves available, and people can actually pitch to more than one agent, and some authors make themselves available for the beginning writers to practice on them before they do the pitch to the agents. So I think that, you know, at a certain point, if I were if I only had an afternoon, that would be the one that I would pick.
The one that you would go to.
Assuming that I knew how to write.
Thank you so much, both of you. KJ Howell, the Freedom Broker, and Professor David Morrell, I prefer to call him Professor. If you have not read his Victorian thrillers, you're in for a treat. They're absolutely magnificent. And as a matter of fact, if you post your name on my page in Authors on Facebook, Authors on the Air, and say, I listen to your conversation, I'm going to give you a chance to choose a book by either KJ Howell or David Morrell. I promise you won't be disappointed. It'll be my pleasure to gift it to you. First one who posts gets the book.
I'll mail it. You don't need to give it. I'll give it.
Well, you can send one to me with a signature. I'm going to send you my email. The heck with that.
So now you're going to put your own name on the website so you can get
exactly.
The free book.
No, I'm going to write you an email. You're a professor.
All right. You figure this all out.
I love you both from the bottom of my heart. You are two of the very best people it's ever been my honor to meet. Thank you so much for being with me. Thank you, listeners, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Have a great night, everybody. Good night.